It was in one of the poorest, shabbiest parts of a great city, a street of tenements, an occasional pot plant on a windowsill accenting rather than relieving the decay. One building had been demolished, leaving a small, shadowy space like a gap in a row of yellowing teeth. Kids use this junk-strewn oasis as a playground. Indefinable games with bits of wood and tired gray tennis balls. On an adjoining wall, an inscription, crudely daubed in whitewash on the dusty brick. Three heroic words in a seeming morass of human futility.
Work for peace.
To mark the 13th anniversary of the signing of the United Nations Charter in the city of San Francisco on June 26, 1945, United Nations Radio offers some reflections from living memory on mankind's progress towards an ancient ideal. We have called this program The Pursuit of Peace. Our host is Clifton Fadiman.
Right? So you don't take words daubed on a wall too seriously. Youthful exuberance, you say, or an adult obsession. Granted, generally. Yet the story of poor old Belshazzar is not without its point. And at the risk of sounding rather sentimental, I must confess that in the sight of those three words,
work for peace,
on that particular wall, I found a certain symbolism. Equate the frustration, the ugliness, the distress of life in that shabby street with the fear, the suspicion, and, yes, the frustration which blights so much of our international life today. And it's not difficult to equate the impulse, the motive of the man who painted the words with the grander global work, which today I believe is food for confidence. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my role in these reflections to represent this impulse, this motive, this universal and insatiable appetite for community. And now may I introduce my three guests. Their names and nationalities are unimportant. Their ages are essential. You, sir, would you come to the microphone? A somewhat showy entrance, sir. Do you always move to the clatter of drums?
These days, sir, very, very rarely. You might say I've been reduced to ceremonial. But the sound is a not inappropriate signature of my time.
And that was?
My birth year, sir, was 1890.
Oh, now, if you just wait a moment for the others, would the second guest come in, please?
I'd say this is a signature for my time, too. I recall nothing in it to inspire a more frivolous noise. And frankly, I see no reason to change it.
A discouraging position, sir. What is your time?
Middling. My birth year was 1916.
I see. And now we are to be joined by one more. Would our last guest come in, please? You have no signature, sir? No audible form of entrance?
Who needs one? Look, I'm much more interested in the sort of sound that will accompany my ultimate exit, if you get my meaning.
We shall try to arrive at it. But you haven't given us your birth date.
1940.
Well, now that we're assembled, will you all be seated? I'd like to begin by asking our oldest guest a question.
Please do.
Why, sir, do you consider your entrance with drums just now appropriate for your time.
Not for the reason you're probably imagining. No, sir. Those drums make a clean, clear, definite sound. And that's the way it was when I was a boy, for me and millions like me, no matter where they came from. In our time, the world had a clear head and a keen eye. Make no mistake, we knew the difference between right and wrong, with no ifs or buts.
Oh, come, come. Next you'll tell us you were all sweetness and peace.
Well, since you mentioned peace, yes. It was peaceful then. We'd had a century of great scientific and technical progress behind us, and the major powers hadn't come to real blows since, well, almost since Napoleon.
Not real blows, I agree. But they were a bit like a crowd of determined housewives jockeying for position at a bargain sale.
What do you mean?
Do you never heard of spheres of influence, annexation? Didn't they teach you all about the battles and uprisings in the East? Or the wars and incidents in Africa?
Natural, healthy competition.
Oh, shades of old Friedrich Nietzsche. What was it he says? It is mere illusion and petty sentiment to expect much from mankind if it forgets how to make war.
Gentlemen, gentlemen, I don't think we'll gain much by leveling criticism at each other's generation. And in my view, you've both overlooked the most important trend of all in the years before the First World War. With your permission, I submit a quotation.
We cannot fail to recognize the fact that one of the principal guarantees to the maintenance of peaceful relations between nations is a more intimate knowledge of mutual interests and needs. The progress of the present conference is the greatest that mankind has ever made in this direction.
Unquote. Any clues to that present conference? Where and when those words were spoken?
Well, just a minute.
Not much of a conference man himself.
If your middle-aged guest may make his first comment.
Certainly. We've been waiting.
Well, I'm afraid I've grown rather suspicious of sentiments like those. I don't personally think it matters much where, when, or by whom those words were uttered. Plus ça change, as they say.
You're still discouraged, I see. Well, let me give you the answer to my question. Those words were spoken on October 18th, 1907. The speaker was the president of the Second International Peace Conference at The Hague in Holland. There'd been an earlier one in 1899.
The Hague Conference, as I might have guessed. You honestly attach importance to them. Peace conferences. All they ever did at The Hague was refine the rules of war a bit. You know, cut his throat by all means, but no kidney punching, please.
No, I know. That's one widely held view of those conferences.
You mean there are others? Did you ever read the resolution they adopted on disarmament at the first conference? The restriction of military charges, it said, is extremely desirable. A giant stride, that. Really helpful, with everyone, as our young colleague put it, jostling at the bargain counter.
I haven't noticed you young fellows doing much better.
Ah, oh, come now.
You including me in that?
Gentlemen, please, our rules of procedure, no fruitless criticism. I'd just like to say that whatever may be thought of the failures of the Hague conferences, they did make a positive contribution to the pursuit of peace, and an historically important one in the long perspective that must be used here. When Tsar Nicholas sent out his invitations to the first meeting in 1899, 26 sovereign states accepted. It was the first time anything like this had ever happened in time of peace. 26 nations trying, at least on the surface, to reach agreement on matters affecting them all. Then they met again in 1907, and on September 21st that year, they passed a resolution.
The conference recommends to the powers the assembly of a third peace conference.
Thinking was responding to needs. I submit that the nations, even then, were beginning to sense the need for some more or less regular meeting ground. They were beginning to realize that occasional spasmodic contact was not quite enough.
Maybe they were, but they never got around to that third conference, did they? Events, sir, events. I suppose you remember 1914?
Yeah. Who, me?
Yes.
Oh, yes, vividly, like yesterday.
Oh.
How could I ever forget that first day? Marching along up the slope, bayonets gleaming in the sun. The bands playing, the flags. The children running along beside the column. A cheering crowd. Of course, it got a bit grim later on. But we knew what was right, make no mistake.
I remember 1939 myself. We had some flags that day, too, and there were crowds, but somehow it all seemed a little... oh, I don't know, a little apprehensive, perhaps. And the cheers lacked that certain... what shall I say? Exaltation? A significant change, possibly.
Possibly? Though only in an emotional sense. But real peace needs a much firmer, more stable foundation. But let me ask you the same question I asked before. Why did you choose these rather somber throbbings as your period signature?
Why? Oh, I think I can give you an answer. You see, I was just a toddler when they called a halt in 1918. My old man came home a bit the worse for gas. Nothing fatal, you understand. Just enough to make him eloquently anti-war. Oh, yes, he was red-hot for peace, my old man was. Meetings, rallies, used to take me along. Drag me onto the platform as a symbol of tomorrow or something and shout, "Don't let it happen to him!" That was a very widespread feeling in those days, back in the 20s. Of course, I loved every minute of it, though at a later date, as you may have noticed, I've taken refuge in cynicism.
Yes, we have noticed.
As a more recent symbol of tomorrow... and one, I might add, who's already outgrown the role. I must say I find cynicism most unsatisfying. It's just too easy.
Careful you don't grow into a prig, young man. May I continue?
Please.
Well, this early plunge bath of moral indignation had its effects. By the time I was 20, olive branches were almost sprouting out of my ears. I was a staunch supporter of every peaceful cause you care to mention. But at that stage, you had to be quite remarkably obtuse not to realize that every one of them was lost, and that it was too late to do anything about it. In Europe, they were already testing the sirens and digging slit trenches in the park. So off to war we went, with kit bags full of tattered illusions, the knowledge that it had to be, and the determination to do our bit, if you'll pardon the stoic decency of that expression. An odd mixture, when you come to think of it.
And I'm afraid the inevitable byproduct of too facile an optimism. But tell me, among the causes you and people of your age championed, you didn't include the League of Nations?
The League? Yes, certainly we included it.
And you were disappointed?
Weren't you?
Frankly, no. I wasn't disappointed in the League. Not when its record is viewed in the long perspective, if you'll pardon me using that expression again.
Well, I don't know. Our optimism may have been too facile. Yours is quite awe-inspiring. But go on. State your case.
Well, go back to the Hague conferences for a moment. The nations got together then because there was a feeling, admittedly embryonic, that it could be to their mutual advantage. By 1916, this feeling had seeped into the consciousness of millions. The catalysis of bloodshed and destruction began to give it shape. Voices began to give it expression. One thinks immediately, of course, of President Wilson.
Wilson? Wilson was an incurable idealist.
And since when has idealism been a rude word?
Procedure, gentlemen, procedure. No slings and arrows. Let me recall three statements by President Wilson which illustrate the evolution of the feeling into the idea. First, from February 1916.
I pray God that if this contest have no other result, it will at least have the result of creating an international tribune and producing some sort of joint guarantee of peace on the part of the great nations.
Second, from January 1917.
If the peace presently to be made is to endure, it must be made secure by the organized major forces of mankind.
And third, from 1918, the last of Wilson's famous 14 points for peace.
A general association of nations must be formed by treaties which would mutually guarantee the political independence and territorial integrity of all states.
You see what was happening? Signs of erosion were at last appearing on the monoliths of absolute sovereignty that had stood for centuries, because you can't have association without obligation. Well, as we all know, during the peace conference at Paris in 1919, the Covenant of the League of Nations was drafted and approved.
May I interrupt?
Do.
I apologize for being blatantly wise after the event. At my age, it's about all I can be. But doesn't it strike you as, well, inappropriate that anybody should try to weave a really durable fabric of international law and order in the highly emotional atmosphere of a victor and vanquished peace conference?
Well, I think we can agree that we've discovered better settings since 1919.
Oh, I've no stomach for this kind of talk. It seems to me you fellows ignore the one right that really matters when the chips are down. The right to defend yourself. And if you're attacked, to make sure it doesn't happen again.
Nobody's denying anybody the right of self-defense, now or at any other time. But look, I once read a description of the League. The writer said it appeared as the honorable daughter of a disreputable mother.
Very good.
And who was this mother? She was the sort of mentality you've just heard.
Gentlemen, I must insist.
No, the boy has a point. Throughout its whole life, the League was plagued by this malignant maternal influence. Put the ingredients in alphabetical order. Arrogance, cynicism, opportunism, provincialism. You name them, my time had them.
I thought you said you were a cynic. That didn't sound in character exactly.
Oh, we have our moments, even now, you know.
Good. But, gentlemen, I must again ask you not to indulge in these exchanges. We're in search of continuity, not scapegoats. And anyway, the political facts behind the failure of the League are no longer really live points of controversy. The only valuable deduction to be drawn from the experience of the interwar years is that the League, despite all its limitations, did give new strength to the fragile bones of international organization. It enlarged the opportunities for fruitful contact and cooperation. But now we've reached the stage at which we must consider the time of our youngest guest. I have a question I want to ask him, but before that, I'd like you to check with me the timing, the duration of an historic moment. You're all wearing watches?
Yes,
I am.
Good. And I just happen to have a stopwatch. Now imagine you're in San Francisco on June 25th, 1945. The 9th plenary meeting of the United Nations Conference on International Organization is in session, with Lord Halifax of the United Kingdom as the presiding officer of the day. From the official verbatim record of that meeting, we extract the words he spoke. Watches ready?
Ready.
Right.
Right. Quote.
If I have your pleasure, may I invite the leaders of delegations who are in favor of the approval of the charter to rise in their places and be good enough to remain standing while they are counted. Thank you. Are there any against? The Charter of the United Nations is unanimously approved.
Including the cheers, I made it just 30 seconds. And you?
Check.
Fair enough.
Roger.
Behind those infinitesimal moments, the centuries stretch back. The groping, fumbling centuries since mankind first began to clutch at his ideal. And behind them, too, are the more immediate decades of disappointment, and the urgent months as well, when the shape of San Francisco was molded at the wartime meetings at Quebec, Moscow, Tehran, Dumbarton Oaks, and Yalta. Then came the 30 seconds. Though the formal signing of the charter took place the next day, June 26th, it was in those moments on the 25th, in the reasoned impulse and the muscular act which brought 50 delegations to their feet, that we assumed the responsibility to carry the experience of the past into the millennia of opportunity which lie ahead. And now a question to our youngest guest. When you came in just now with no audible signature of your time, you said, I think, who needs one?
That's right, I did.
Did you really mean it, or were you just being evasive?
You do make it difficult, don't you? Yes, I was being evasive. I need one badly. There are not many things we can be certain about, but we can give you three. One is that we can't, nor would if we could, pick up a kettle drum and start worshipping the old tribal gods that this grandfather here still seems to obey.
Well?
Another is that we cannot accept, in fact we reject, the dreary rumblings and throbbings of father here, whether he's a cynic or anything else.
Ah, youth.
And the third?
Well, we haven't as yet had our baptism of fire, but we know perfectly well that if our turn does come, and if there are musicians on parade, it won't be a case of oom-pa-pa, oom-pa-pa, but a slow chorus of this is the way the band plays, not with a beat but a whimper. In short, we are suffering from chronic dissatisfaction and impatience.
Dissatisfaction with what?
How long have you got? I could talk for days.
Just one example will do.
Do you ever read newspapers? Watch TV? Listen to the radio? I do. I'm very attentive to the makers and interpreters of news. But sometimes, you know, when I see their faces or hear their voices, a funny thing happens. My brain doesn't register a human face in mind. Instead, I get an image of a sort of bulging, overripe Camembert cheese. I have a wild urge to prick the pallid, wrinkled skin with a pin. But I don't. I'm afraid that if I did, I'd be immediately swamped by a flood of lethal butterfat and probably end up petrified like a Pompeian dog.
Incredible.
I think you're being rather unfair, but go on. What about your impatience?
Oh, here I can be more specific. Look, is there a soul alive today who can't imagine, or even see, a war breaking out in the future for precisely the same old reasons that have produced it in the past? I doubt it. And even the prospect of everyone being pulverized into a fine hot powder is not, in itself, a guarantee that war won't start. And surely, even if it was a guarantee, we should have the wit to do better. Now, the way we see it, the only way to stop violence is to remove the possibility of using it. A government does this within its own territory because it has a monopoly of the use of force. All right. A lot of us would like to extend the system to the world as a whole. The conclusion is obvious, they say. We need a central authority, a world government, strong enough to stop any individual country causing trouble. Well, personally, I'm not sure. And anyway, there's not a hope in years of getting a world government. That's one reason why I'm impatient.
Any comments, gentlemen?
I only hope I shan't be here if the world this young puppy wants ever comes to be.
You won't be. As for me, no comment.
I prefer the company of men, not a troop of marionettes.
Thank you.
Well, gentlemen, I think the time has come for me to do what all good moderators do, sum up the proceedings and add the necessary comments from my position of independence. I think the position of our first guest suggests a reluctance to recognize fully the whole spectrum of change that we've witnessed during the last 50 years or so. The difference between the spectacle of a bearded and begoggled balloonist floating placidly on the breeze and the sound of a satellite beeping through space is obvious enough. But immense social and political changes have accompanied this technical and scientific progress, and the implications of these tend to escape him. In international affairs, he hankers after what he'd probably call a more natural arrangement, where all problems are fed through old and well-tested pipes. This, he feels, is a more effective, more realistic way of doing things. Do I interpret you correctly, sir?
Sometimes I feel very sad.
I can understand that. Our other two guests are, I think, closer than they imagine. Even though one carries the crutches of despair and the other the banner of impatience, both would like to see all international organizations welded overnight into a single world authority with the power to enforce the law upon the nations. And the continued remoteness of this state of affairs upsets them. But, gentlemen, while respecting your objective, I must make what I believe to be the essential point. Though the interdependence of all nations, all peoples, is today such an obvious reality, world community does not exist. The course we are now following, lying as it does somewhere between the traditional and the ideal, is the only course we can follow. It is the only sensible and truly realistic course.
And you honestly believe that we are making progress?
I have never been more certain about anything.
Can you prove it?
Proof? Can anyone prove the existence of thought in the abstract? Can anyone give the quality of change a tangible shape, except in the forms and institutions it produces? Gentlemen, even those who wrote and signed the United Nations Charter 13 years ago did not claim their work was perfect. Yet, as a measure of growth, it is the finest expression of the impulse, the motive, the appetite so far recorded in all history. The development it represents over all previous achievements can be demonstrated in many ways. I would like to contrast the opening sentences of two documents, if you, sir, wouldn't mind reading this one.
I'm glad to. The Covenant of the League of Nations.
And you, sir, this one?
Preamble to the United Nations Charter.
We shall juxtapose them, phrase by phrase, starting with the Covenant.
The high contracting parties.
We, the peoples.
In order to promote international cooperation.
Determined to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war.
There we can stop. There is a subtlety in the difference between the two wordings, a subtlety to be measured in terms of breadth and depth, and in the intensity of human perception. But, gentlemen, it is a subtlety which fades as the charter unfolds in the fullness of its scope. I'd like to draw your attention to Chapter 1, Article 1, Clause 4, under the heading Purposes and Principles. The UN, it says, is
to be a center for harmonizing the actions of nations in the attainment of common ends.
A center for harmony. A framework for operations in every field of endeavor. Though fact and forces set limits on achievement, though dangers and fears may frequently obscure the patient and relentless process of reconciliation, this we have and this we must nourish. Never was this more necessary than today, when technological discovery makes cooperative existence the only alternative to collective destruction. I said at the beginning that I found a certain symbolism in those words daubed on the wall. I was wrong. There is nothing symbolic about them. They are as clear, concrete, and challenging as any three words in any language.
Work for peace.
You have just heard The Pursuit of Peace, a program commemorating the 13th anniversary of the signing of the United Nations Charter. The old man was played by William Jackson, the middle man by Frederick Rolfe, the young man by Louis Edmonds. Their host was Clifton Fadiman. The Pursuit of Peace was written and produced by the international staff of United Nations Radio in New York.